Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'll be talking today with one of the most distinctive figures in pop music, the Swedish star, Robin. Baby, it's so real to me, now that it's over. Robin is as adored by fans as she is admired by critics. That's later this hour. Now, in Washington, staff writer Susan Glasser spent a lot of last week running around Capitol Hill. She always does. She's always up there. But this week, she found herself there on a day that wasn't all business.
Okay. So we're here right now, and the motorcade with President Bush's casket appears to be arriving. It has landed at Andrews Air Force Base. It is now being driven into the Capitol. And to the rotunda of the Capitol is where he's going to lie in state. There it is right there. And you can see it being driven here. A dramatic scene of the Capitol at sunset. George H.W. Bush returning to the place where he served as a young member of Congress many, many years ago. It's quiet. There's a number of mostly very young Hill staffers, some local people as well who've gathered, taking pictures, taking videos. This is the first time this has happened in 12 years. It's an unusual moment of quiet in Washington as well, almost an interregnum between the fierce partisan fury of the elections and the fierce partisan fury of the new Congress when Republican United government will end and the Democrats will take control of the House. And everyone expects it to be an era of even more confrontation between President Trump and his critics.
As Susan said, the new year brings a major change in the balance of power on Capitol Hill, with the House flipping firmly into Democratic hands, while the Senate ticked slightly further into the red. In congressional offices, some new members are measuring the drapes, while their departing colleagues are plotting their next steps.
So we're headed upstairs in the Hart Senate office building to Senator Claire McCaskill's office. It's her last week there in the office. You know, I've always really liked Senator McCaskill. She is a very outspoken member of the Senate, but it's a lot easier to be outspoken after you've lost.
Claire McCaskill was elected to the Senate from Missouri in 2006 after serving as a prosecutor and holding other state offices there. She's been considered one of the most moderate, centrist Democrats in the Senate. But in 2016, Missouri voters went for Donald Trump by a whopping 19 points, and in last month's midterms, McCaskill lost to Republican Josh Hawley. She and her staff are in the process of packing boxes.
Sitting entry room that we're sitting in right now, the reception room in Senator McCaskill's office, is filled with, of course, Missouri's most famous odds-defying Democrat, Harry Truman. We're sitting right now, right beneath a picture of the famous Dewey Defeats Truman headline on the day of Harry Truman's 1948 presidential election victory. McCaskill did not have a Dewey Beats Truman moment a couple weeks ago on her election day, but arguably even her career as a Democrat at a time when Republicans were rapidly gaining control over most of the political offices in Missouri. She'd already defied the odds a number of times before.
All right, let me think about that.
Come on in.
Hi.
Good.
Nice to see you.
Susan Glasser.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm good.
Where
do you guys want to
set up around the table here?
All right, so in the spirit of blunt-spoken exit interviews, we're sitting in your really lovely corner office here in the Capitol. Is there anything that you won't miss about this place?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
the brutal schedule. I used to joke that Southwest was my school bus, and I'd get on Southwest every Monday morning and come home on Southwest every Thursday night. I will miss the not getting companion pass by June, because I almost always get my companion pass fairly quickly because I'm on Southwest so often. And not having the freedom of a schedule that you can set, that is set by others. I won't miss the gotcha stuff that has become more prevalent in the 12 years I've been here. I obviously will miss the people, and I'll really miss the work. And I will miss the opportunity to try to move the needle on things I believe in, and obviously helping people at home with problems that we do pretty well at.
Is the Senate a worse place today than it was in 2006?
I think worse is a loaded term. I think it is more in jeopardy of being marginalized by the American people because it doesn't work very well. I think people around here, we get so caught up in how dysfunctional we are. Okay, like this is a good example this week. Okay, we're now doing a CR.
A continuing resolution
instead of a budget. And now the big question of the day, is that going to be 1 week or 2 weeks? Really? And because it's become the new normal, many members have never been here when there was actually an appropriations process that was more open and more debatable and more amendations
over the budget. It's blown me away. Congress has basically stopped doing this core part of its job.
Yeah. And by the way, when we do it, it has been done by a handful of people in the back room.
Yeah. It's incredible. My son asked me the other day, my 13-year-old, if I thought that speed readers would get a lot of jobs on Capitol Hill because they're always releasing those huge bills at the last minute. I thought that was such a cute thing to say.
That
I was like,
cute.
You know, Theo, I'm not aware of like a room full of speed readers.
No.
It's a good idea, though.
No, but the problem is they wouldn't want to hire them because the people who write the bills don't want anybody to read them. The people who are there is a handful of people who's actually read everything. And the last thing they want is somebody digging through it all. Same thing with legislation. Legislation is now being written in the majority leader's office instead of in committee. And so the more dysfunctional this place gets, the more people out there in the real world are going, well, you guys suck. You guys are terrible. All of you, pox on all your house. And so the price we're paying is increased cynicism by the American people. And that's not a good thing. I mean, that is something that's very dangerous for this democracy. One positive thing that could come out of the Trump era is that more elected officials would realize that people will be forgiving of you if you say something stupid once or twice or three times or, you know, several times a year. But the lack of authenticity, I think, is really problematic for a lot of people around this building. They are so poll-driven and so scripted. And then I think it's easier to kind of swipe with a broad brush and say, well, they're all phony.
Some people have described President Trump as almost like an accelerant to that, you know, putting those trends on turbocharge when it comes to Washington. How has he made Congress different in the last 2 years?
I don't think it's fair to blame him because it was plenty bad
right
before he arrived on the scene. That's one of the reasons he arrived on the scene, by the way.
That's right. And Congress has, of course, always been unpopular. We should note that
right.
Congress is never, it's not like it was a super functional place before.
We've never been anywhere close to firefighters on the approval scale. I mean, we are nurses. I mean, those are like the...
You're fighting it out with journalists right at the bottom of the barrel.
Exactly. On the other hand, because of almost the cult of his power in the Republican Party, my colleagues that are Republicans that used to spend some time in the middle working to get things done have really kind of gone into their offices and shut their doors.
You tweeted the other day, what have you done with Lindsey Graham?
Yeah, no, we are worried about Lindsey. Lindsey, I'm sure he would say the same thing about me. That would drive me crazy from time to time. But I also knew that when there were things that we could agree on, he was a great partner and somebody who was fearless about whether or not it was, you know, the right thing to do in terms of the Republican brand. It doesn't feel like that Lindsey is around much right now. Now, maybe he'll resurface, but it feels like he's gone away and all of us are mourning him.
Do you think that the other Republican members, I mean, virtually all of them were against Trump in the 2016 primaries, and, you know, there's endless citations by people like me of all the times they called Trump a kook and unsuited to be president and the like. But have these folks fundamentally changed their mind? Is it purely opportunistic? I mean, are they just no longer free traders anymore, or they're just waiting him out?
They're waiting him out. I mean, this guy would be, he should hear the way these guys talk about him behind his back. You know, I'm sure that would unleash all manner of tweets, but, and I would never name any names.
But I'm sure it's people, including many Missouri Republicans.
Oh, no question. And this is the thing. I mean, the danger for my Republican colleagues that know that many of the things that Trump has done are not their values. It's not the way they see governing. It's now his party, period. And I believe there will be a time down the road that some of them will rue the day that they did not speak up more forcefully, did not say, wait a minute, this idea of using national security as an excuse for a really aggressive trade war with no exit plan. And how about the deficit? You know, they've just abandoned any attempt. And that is really going to hurt sooner rather than later, because as interest rates go up, that budget process is going to get more and more difficult. It's frustrating to watch. I understand it on an intellectual level, but it doesn't mean that it's not sad.
Well, it's interesting. So you're highlighting sort of the policy conundrum, which is part of it, right? He is an outsider to their party. He's come in. He's won. He doesn't really stand for the same things that have been Republican orthodoxy, things like free trade, Russia, arguably, the deficit. Then there's also kind of the character issue, which may become more ripe next year, depending on where these investigations go. Will Mitch McConnell stand with him till the end of the end of the end of the end? I mean, theirs is kind of an unlikely alliance too, right?
Mitch McConnell, I think, will stand with him as long as it is in the interests of the majority of the Senate right now, which is Republicans. He looks at everything through the lens of how can I stay majority floor leader? How can I become majority floor leader, and how can I stay majority floor leader?
I think that's right. A lot of people don't understand the thing about Mitch McConnell is that his dream, unlike a lot of the rest of the Senate, was not to be president. It really is to be Senate majority leader.
No,
LBJ at the height of his power is his model, right?
That's exactly right. And everything he's done and everything he will do will be done with that focus. He is fighting with Trump only when he thinks it's necessary to protect the Republican members of the Senate. He will challenge Trump only when he thinks it's in the best interests of the Republican members of the Senate. He will be quiet and say there's nothing wrong with Trump, or pivot and deflect if he thinks it's in the best interests of the Republican members of the U.S. Senate. And so that's what will be the determining factor for Mitch McConnell, is how he can stay in power.
So you obviously represented Missouri. A lot of people say you're one of the last of the Trump country Democrats, that in the future it's just going to be impossible to win in a place that has the demographics of a Missouri, with this heavy representation of rural counties and the like. Is there a future for Democrats in a place like Missouri?
Oh, sure. I got 45% of the vote, and I think if I had never been in politics and had an interesting resume and was an outsider, I think it would have been even closer. So this is a tough patch for Democrats in Missouri, but I do not believe it's the end of the Democrats in Missouri. I think, you know, it wasn't that long ago. It was November of 2016 when the majority of the statewide office holders in Missouri were Democrats. Well, a state doesn't change that much that quickly. This is a thing that was exacerbated by, and let's give the guy who ran against me some credit. He's young, he's telegenic, he's articulate,
He, you know, clearly is intelligent, and he took direction well by his campaign team and stayed very disciplined in the last 3 months of the campaign. And so the Kavanaugh thing helped him. The caravan helped him. So I think there were a lot of intangibles that helped Josh Hawley win this election.
Was the caravan made up? Was it a fake issue?
Well, no, I don't think it is. I mean, there are now 6,000 people that are poor and tired and hungry and living in squalor trying to get into the United States.
Do you need the military to fight 6,000 people?
I think all of that might have been political optics. I do think that the caravan presented a problem. It just wasn't a problem that was presented to the American people, that somehow we needed to have the military on the border to what, mow them down as they came across the border, what, shoot them? I mean, that was like, that was made for television bullshit.
Trump came in really hard against you. He was there twice in Missouri in the last week alone. Did you do something to piss him off?
No, I just think they looked at the races that they thought they could win to hold the Senate. I think Mitch McConnell did this. I think Mitch McConnell directed this. I made the joke during the campaign that he'd come so often, I figured he was building a golf course somewhere in Missouri, because Donald Trump never goes anywhere that frequently unless there's golf involved. But it was painful because I knew that he was building enthusiasm on his side about 90 days before the election. We felt pretty good. And then the enthusiasm on their side just popped up.
Around the Kavanaugh thing?
And around his visits.
Mm-hmm. And around his visits. Interesting. What about your party, though? Democrats have gone ahead and reelected Schumer here on the Senate side to be majority leader. Nancy Pelosi looks like she will be elected Speaker of the House. This is not exactly a fresh new face of leadership for the party. Are they the right people to challenge Trump?
Oh, I don't. Yeah. I mean, I think Schumer's really good at his job. And I publicly opposed Harry Reid and his reelection at one point, just because I didn't think he was the right guy for the job at that moment. I think Chuck's the right guy for the job at this moment because he is very good at trying to pull people together when it really matters and giving people the space to vote against the party line and not get on him. I mean, he was great with me. I mean, whenever I needed to vote against most of the Democratic caucus because of I had a difference of opinion with them, he never made me feel uncomfortable or that I was somehow betraying him or my fellow Democrats. So it really more is about who is coming up that is inspiring. Who are the young voices and faces that
but
are inspiring.
But also, is it who they are and, you know, is the center of gravity changed in the party? If Republicans have seen their party sort of taken over by Trump, there is this interesting split. You know, people like you are more and more a vanishing breed when it comes from, you know, senators who are from Republican-leaning states. Is it still possible to, is there a center?
Oh, yeah. There will always be a center. It's not heavily populated right now. But when the pendulum swings back, it will be more populated. You know, Kyrsten Sinema won in Arizona as a moderate. Beto lost in Texas as a progressive. Their states are very similar in terms of their makeup. And Kyrsten said, I want to work together. I'm a moderate. She was an unabashed moderate. Beto was not that. And so if you wanted to make the argument, you could say, well, wait a minute. If this is all about just us being purely progressive, then what's up? Why did Kyrsten Sinema win and Beto lose? So, but I think both of them are examples of new faces that will remind people that we have good ideas and that we get it. And we understand how frustrated they are about their health care and about their wages, and that we can actually be helpful. And I'm fairly optimistic about that.
You know, I love that you're ending this note and this conversation on an optimistic note. We don't get a lot of optimism in Washington these days, I have to say. But I love looking around your office, which is in a partial state of deconstruction. I guess this is your last week?
No, I think, well, it depends.
Well,
on the
I guess
CR.
It was supposed to be the last
depends
week.
On yeah. when we pretend that we're actually getting a budget done. I think it will be next week or perhaps the following week. But it's late enough in the game that I've begun packing up, so it is a little bit. A lot of my favorite items have already been packed away.
Although you still have a fantastic collection of Harry Trumaniana, if you could call it that.
I am such a fangirl of Harry Truman. I mean, if everybody could be more like Harry Truman was. Imagine what it took for Harry Truman to integrate the armed services. Imagine what the polling said. Can you imagine how many people in America at that moment said, yeah, it's a really good idea for us to integrate the armed services? He just did it. When he left office, he was very unpopular. And now everybody wants to be like him. I am embarrassingly well-informed on Harry Truman. And the one thing that he always did that I swore I would do would just speak plainly. And I think it is one medicine that can cure some of the illness that is around this place. That's who he was. He was never afraid to say exactly what he thought. He never used a $5 word when a nickel word was good enough. He spoke in plain declarative sentences. He answered questions. I feel good about my effort to emulate him in that regard. And I'm going to have a lot of fun continuing to do that for years to come.
Senator Claire McCaskill, thank you so much for being with us on New Yorker Radio.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Claire McCaskill. She served 12 years as senator from Missouri and departs this month. She spoke with Susan Glasser, our Washington correspondent. I'm David Remnick, and still this hour, a visit with a one-of-a-kind pop artist from Sweden, Robin. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. Come get your honey. No, you're not gonna get what you need. But baby, you have what you want. Come get your honey. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For the past 25 years, starting when she was all of 14 years old, the singer Robin has been on the cutting edge of pop music. Her sound is sparse, complex, ahead of the trends, and she always seems like she's writing from a few years into the future. For most of those 25 years making music, Robin has avoided the big hit-making producers who somehow put their own stamp on an artist. Instead, she's become almost an oxymoron, an indie pop star. And while she's respected, even frankly adored by so many critics, she's also genuinely popular, with the top 10 singles and multiple Grammy nominations to prove it. Robin was born Robin Carlson in Sweden, where she still lives. And her last album, Body Talk, came out in 2010, but for most of the intervening years, Robin has been pretty much out of public view. Following a breakup and a close friend's death, she slipped into a depression serious enough that she had trouble getting out of bed sometimes or leaving the house. She eventually started recording again and recently released an album called Honey. The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino said of it, "The force of her conviction continues to hold together what often seems impossible, musically or otherwise, maximum sadness, felt as the bedrock of absolute joy." Robin talked with me from her office in Sweden last week. Robin, this is your first album in 8 years. Is it strange to be back in the limelight after all that time? You're touring, and it's been a long time for touring, too. What's it like being back out in the hot lights?
It's nice. I'm enjoying myself. Maybe in a way I'm in a different place than I was last time I released an album, in the sense that I'm maybe not as, like, how can I put it, not as, like, willing maybe to work as hard. Like, I really enjoy my downtime. I really enjoy being in the studio. I really enjoy, like, having my own time, basically.
You wrote your first song when you were 11 years old, which is pretty darn early. What were you listening to? What singers, what music was meaning the most to you? You signed with a record company at 14. So a lot of music must have been coming at you, shaping this young voice, this young singer, this young composer. I wonder what was most important.
I loved Michael Jackson. I listened to Off the Wall and Thriller a lot. I think I heard my first Prince album when I was about 8. It was the Batman soundtrack. and I loved it. I still do, actually. I think it's underrated. I mean, I think TLC made maybe the biggest impression on me as a teenager because they were young women and they were, you know, quite tough and like strong and still girly and cute and fun. I think they were probably the group. If you would have asked me, you know, as a 15-year-old, I would have said TLC.
And when you listen to that, those early songs of yours, the early music, and it's now quite a while ago, it's almost 20 years ago, what are you hearing in the young Robin?
I think I'm hearing, you know, a lot of, like, will, a lot of willpower, a lot of, like, energy. Sometimes I feel like I can understand where I was trying to move in a different direction, but maybe really didn't know how. And it took me a long time until I actually created the environment where I felt like I could make music that was more on my own terms. But I think the fact that I was writing still gave me like an outlet.
When you were just 18, you released My Truth. And though your first album was released in the United States, this one was not. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, I just don't think that the label that I worked with at the time got it. You know, it wasn't a commercial album.
But you were writing about your experience in abortion, and that's something that most American pop stars certainly wouldn't touch at the time. And not only did you sing about it, you refused to make any changes in order to reach some imagined big audience. Mm-hmm. That seems a pretty tough thing to do, no? What was that episode like for you?
Well, I don't think it was a tough decision. I was more kind of amazed of like how narrow-minded the label I was with at the time was. Not here in Sweden, but in America, I think that song became an issue. That wasn't a big deal for me, actually. I'm happy that I wrote the song and that I kind of stuck by it. So I knew you would, and I never imagined you'd be so good, and it hurts me so to let you go. I want you to live, but I'm not all I want to give.
What's your process like as a writer of songs?
I think writing continuously, like having a routine, is really important, at least for me. But then I really believe also that some ideas, they just show up when they're ready. You might have to like get the engine like going and warm it up for a long time, but like once it's like ready, once you're like in the zone, it's easier for those ideas to show up. And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I'm not superstitious in that way. I wouldn't say that I think they come from God, because I don't feel like I believe in God, but I believe in that they come from the unconsciousness, like a deeper place that's harder to get to by thinking.
Well, something equally mysterious happened after Body Talk came out. After it came out, you were a huge success, a big star, 5 albums. And then suddenly you went, at least where the public was concerned, silent. Are you able to talk about what happened and why you withdrew from your public life?
Well, I mean, I was ready to make an album in 2014. I was preparing to, like, go back into the studio. And then, you know, I think, like, for a lot of people, life was just, you know, unexpected things happened. And
you experienced some real losses at that time.
Yeah, exactly. A friend of mine died, and I was in a relationship that ended around the same time. I felt like the things that I was trying to, or the things that I was writing about, were quite, you know, layered and complex. They weren't quick. like Missing You is a really good example. I wrote the melody and like the beginning of the lyrics in 2014 in July. And Christian died just right after that, and my friend. And I really didn't know how to finish those lyrics at that point, because it started out as a love song, and then it became about, you know, my friend that had passed away, and then the relationship I was in kind of fell apart, and then it became more about that, you know. So it was like this ongoing thing of like where my experiences were just changing all the time, and I didn't know how to put all of that into the lyrics. So I just kind of left the song. I worked on other things, even though it was slow and it took time. But I was, you know, I was preparing. I was exploring myself, I guess, in order to be able to put words on all of those experiences eventually. There's this empty space you left behind. Now you're not here with me.
I keep digging through a waste of time. But the you did something that's pretty unusual in the modern world. A lot of people go see a therapist to deal with depression or loss or heartbreak or whatever it might be. You went into it in a way that in the modern world doesn't happen very much anymore. So you went several times a week into real, what I guess is some traditional psychoanalysis. I wonder, what was the effects on your life and what was the effects on your work of that psychoanalytical work that you were doing?
I started it way before I started making this album, like years before. But it wasn't until all these things happened in my life where I really felt like it started to kind of give like real results. You know, I think the therapy definitely had an effect on my music, but I also think that, you know, these things that happened in my life basically also changed my therapy. It was like, you know, it's like it works both ways, I think. But the commitment of going to psychoanalysis is a big one. You have to kind of, you have to do it for some years. And I guess looking back at it now, I can kind of see how you never really know when it's going to start making sense. You just kind of have to commit anyway.
I'd like to break down, if you don't mind, the musical elements of Honey. So let's start by listening to a clip of that. Can you describe the writing of that, the figuring out of the melody and the part that you're singing?
So I was working with this Casio synthesizer for a long time, and I was making songs on these chords that me and Marcus, who plays in my band, and it was really just about the beat for me for like a year or so.
And you're playing around with kind of club music background here, right?
That was what I was doing, but it sounded like something else. we had this like idea of making this like gooey kind of soft production that was still relating to, you know, club music. And Joseph decided to like make his own sample. So there's, we called it like the sauce. It's processed through, you know, lots of things to make it kind of feel like it's moving. And I think to me, that's really what club music is about.
So I want to ask a question that's more about pop music in general. Pop music, dance music, it's a lot of it is associated with sex, with hypersexualized imagery, a lot of it, for years and years. And you've somehow avoided that. You sing about love and sex, but you don't sexualize or over-sexualize your own image or who you are in these songs. And that seems a kind of magic trick, too. Is it something you think about a lot?
I actually don't. I wish I maybe thought about it more. I think that for me, it was always like when I was younger, very like important, or I just felt like I needed to kind of protect myself. I think today it's much easier to, you know, have pink hair and at the same time call yourself a feminist. And I think when I was growing up, being a feminist was like, you know, being a tomboy was or felt liberating to me. And I think I was. So I don't think that I like gave myself space enough to be a sensual person as an artist until way later. And I like things to be layered. I like things to be complicated and complex. And I think if you're allowing things to be, you know, somehow complicated, you can be as sexy as you want, you know.
Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
All the best to you, and good luck in everything.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. Bye.
Robin's album, Honey, came out in the fall. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. Aaron Sorkin is probably best known for The West Wing, and he won an Academy Award for a screenplay for The Social Network, the movie about Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. But Sorkin's roots are on the stage, in live theater, and he's adapted Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird. The show opens on Broadway this month, and I'll talk with Sorkin next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Well, it is that time of year again, and the lists are coming fast and furious. And thank God I've got Amanda Petrusich here to guide us through the year in pop music. Amanda, what's the best thing you've been hearing all year? What just blew your mind?
For me, the big kind of pop music story of 2018 was Ariana Grande. She was the first woman in 3 years to have a single debut at number one on the Hot 100. But what's really remarkable, I think, about her and about her kind of journey and story this year is, you know, she endured this extraordinary tragedy. There was a bombing at a concert she gave in Manchester in the United Kingdom in 2017, you know, 23 people dead. She returned home. Her ex-boyfriend and former collaborator, the rapper Mac Miller, passed away of an accidental overdose. She became engaged to SNL's Pete Davidson, and then that engagement was called off. And throughout all of this, she released a record sort of in the midst of all this turmoil in her life called Sweetener. And the record is sort of, it's a beautiful pop record, and I think just kind of inspiring and lovely in its embrace of, you know, the idea of survival and sort of remaining. And you know, she's 25 years old, and the kind of way in which she sort of approaches the things she's endured, I just find incredible. I mean, I think, God, at that age, I would have been collapsed by all of that. I would have been just totally destroyed by those events. But she released a single just a few weeks ago called Thank You Next. I don't know if you have had a chance
to
It's a kind of kiss off to Pete Davidson, I suppose. You kind of, you know, at least for
who,
me,
who would kiss off Pete Davidson?
Imagine that.
It's kind of unbelievable.
I know. But she released the single Thank You Next that you would have assumed would have been this kind of malevolent, you know, I'm moving on. The title seems to suggest as much. But what's incredible about it is that the chorus has this line, and I will keep this clean for the airwaves. I don't want to work blue, but it's basically, I'm so grateful for my ex. And I just think, who is grateful for their ex, you know? Again, at 25, I certainly did not have the generosity of spirit. Neither at 35 did I have the generosity of spirit to be grateful for my exes. But she is. She remains. She's a tough
woman. That's something to think on.
Yeah.
That is something to think on. Let's hear it.
Thought I'd end up with Shine, but it wasn't a match. Wrote some songs about Ricky. Now I listen and laugh. Even almost got married. Pete, I'm so thankful. Wish I could say thank you to Malcolm, 'cause he was an angel. One taught me love, one taught me patience, and one taught me pain. Now I'm so amazing. I've loved and I've lost. That's not what I see. So look what I got. Look what you taught me. Yeah, for that I say thank you. Next, thank you.
I'm tempted to say it, but I'll say it. Thank you. Next. What have we got next? What else is on your mind and what else is on the list?
I hope that phrase really works its way into your editing vernacular.
I don't think that's going to be a good style.
Papers flying off the desk.
I don't think they'd appreciate it.
Well, my favorite pop single of 2018 was Malamente by the Catalonian singer Rosalia. Her second album is based loosely on an anonymous 13th century poem about the psychic perils of jealousy. So she sort of had me there. It's a record about desire, when desire goes wrong, and particularly the kind of ramifications for women when love turns ugly. So the title translates to badly, and the song itself mixes these kind of traditional flamenco rhythms with elements of pop and reggaeton and hip-hop and R&B. She sings in Spanish, but the lyrics are really spooky, really foreboding, really dark, which for me was in line with, you know, much of 2018, where you're just thinking, God, what awful and terrifying thing lurks around the next corner. And I feel like this song really sort of captured that feeling. It's this sort of cascading series of bad portents, you know, a broken light, voice on the stairs, a dream about a bridge.
Stop, you're cheering me up. You're cheering me up.
Happy holidays. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Rosalia's Malamente?
Ese gritalito roto.
Oh, I've heard this.
Yeah, it's cool.
I have heard this.
She's cool. I think she's going to have a big year next year.
Well, most top 10 lists are, you know, 10. But, you know, in the age of diminishing expectations or shortened attention spans, here's our final one. The final big hit of 2018 from Amanda is...
See, now you have built me up, and it is what I'm about to play is, in fact, not a big hit, but a little under-the-radar gem, which I figured out we've got, you know,
If you say it's a big hit, it's a big
hit.
Yeah,
okay. I declare this... the jam of 2018. This is by a banjo player named Nathan Bowles. Did I lose you at banjo player?
I'm right there with
you. You're with me. The album is called Plainly Mistaken. He is a North Carolina-based musician, known primarily for his drumming, but every once in a while will release one of these extraordinary banjo records. And he is equally informed by sort of traditional Appalachian song, kind of old-time mountain music, but also a sort of avant-garde New York City experimental kind of drone minimalist thing. So it hits all my walls in that way. It's a kind of Roscoe Holcomb meets John Cale. And one of my favorite songs from this record is called Now If You Remember.
You remember, we were talking about God and you.
Appalachian trance music.
Yeah, exactly.
Love that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, happy holidays to you and happy holidays to everyone. This is at least the beginning of a revelatory list from Amanda, who I think will probably write a longer list online
pretty soon. I will, absolutely.
Amanda Petrusic, music writer extraordinaire for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
Amanda Petrusic with three of her favorites this year, Ariana Grande's Sweetener, Rosalia's Malamente, and Nathan Bowles, whose album is called Plainly Mistaken. In the operatic canon, there is no shortage of tragic deaths. By any measure, one of the most awful is the murder of Desdemona by her husband, Othello. The themes of Verdi's opera, like the Shakespeare play it's based on, remain sadly all too contemporary. Racism, power, jealousy, how resentment leads to bitterness and appalling violence. A production of Othello is at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and while the show was in rehearsal, The New Yorker's David Cortava got a look behind the scenes at how violence makes its way to the opera stage.
Into the bowels of the men.
B.H. Barry is a fight director at the Metropolitan Opera. Who knew such a job existed? But if somebody is attacking somebody else while somehow singing at top volume, B.H. Barry has work to do. And to see how it's all done, he took David Cortava way, way down under the big stage.
There are people still trying to get out of here from 2 years ago. The maze is just incredible down here.
B.H. Barry is one of the leading fight directors in the world. He's a kind of master of a lot of different kinds of violence. Huge barroom brawls, intimate knife fights, stranglings, slaps, beheadings, fist fights, a pogrom and Fiddler on the Roof. But he's not a bruiser. He's not a barroom brawler. He's a very elegant-looking gentleman in his 70s. He has a bouncy tuft of silver hair. He seems like an old-timey action movie star, like an Errol Flynn or a Douglas Fairbanks. And like those people, he is very good with a sword.
Normally, whenever there's action in a play that involves actors, I'm asked to come in to protect them, to build a choreographed scene in which they won't get hurt. And so that's part of the job. The other part of the job is, as a fight director, is being able to teach, because a lot of people can't do this stuff. And a lot of opera singers are not necessarily physical people. Because to be an opera singer, you really have to work incredibly hard on training your voice, and it's a total life. It's not like an actor can go away and drink and get in the pub and have fun and do this stuff. These guys are, it's a delicate instrument. They're thoroughbreds. These are the best in the world. But so teaching is a vital part of fight directing. So point at your targets. Point, 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 point. Point. Now, as you do it, look at me the whole time. Think of down.
Right.
You know when you're singing those high notes? Think of down, yeah?
Gravity.
There you go. Down. So, yeah, that's good. Now, think of looking at your watch. You look at your watch when you do the left shot. And look at your watch. Perfect. And again. Back again. There. There. Look at your watch. There. Look at your watch. Close your eyes. There. Yes. 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 Good. Nice stuff. Yeah. Perfect.
Are the skills that your actors learn on stage transferable? In other words, if one of these opera guys went out to a bar and got into a brawl.
No. There was an actor I knew called Michael Redfern and got into a fight in the bar. And I'd been teaching him fights and whatever. And this guy came at him and he blocked it and he pulled the punch. And the guy looked down and went, Jesus, and ran out the bar because he thought that Michael could actually hurt him. And Michael just pulled. No. Don't even go there. Do not try this at home. It's theatre. It's make-believe.
What is the scene we're about to observe?
There's in the play, and also in the opera, is the moment where Michael Cassio, who is the lieutenant to Othello, gets drunk and gets into a fight with one of the captains of the guard. Within that, there are lots of things that happen. Michael Cassio has a group of people that move with him. Their job is to try and get him out of there before he does some real damage, and they don't succeed. That's where the director part comes in, like looking at the story and how I can move it forward. Also, I look at the actors in the fight, and I often will say to them, what would be missing if your character didn't fight? And then that answer will give me what I need to do to choreograph it.
What I'm trying to do, or trying to create now, is the thing that we couldn't do before when we were working on the initial production, which was your guy's involvement with Cassio. I never knew what that was. You came in with him, and then you're fighting him. Chris was saying something. You had a point yesterday that I wanted to kind of...
I was like, why am I not stopping him right here?
Right. And I think the answer to that question is, he is the captain of the guard. Now, he is the person who you came in and you thought he's going to... Maybe one of two of you thinking, he gets like this when he drinks, so maybe that apprehension when he drinks can be there early on. No? Yes? Lexi, can we do that move from swipe at Chris? Swipe at Chris? But he doesn't even need to swipe. I mean, come in and just look at him. There. And you move away from it, yeah? It says something about the character, and it says something about your position in the role of his guard. We have to give him an enormous degree of importance, because he has to lose all that when Othello comes.
I would imagine some scenes require realism and others a bit of theatricality.
Yeah, you have to be careful, because if you get too real, the audience gets scared for the performers. The fine line between being theatrical and being real is very fine. And so I think that we don't look for reality in theater. We look for the representation of reality. And if we're pushed too far in that direction, we're moved out of the theatre into something entirely different.
So that kind of helps a little bit, huh? All right, go.
Easy, man. Left leg. Right shoulder. Head. Left shoulder. Shoulder. Good.
See, that's a moment in which the sword went near to the performer and we went, whoa, that was the reality moment. And that's, we have to take that out, because otherwise the audience would think, oh, you got hit.
Good. Well, can we do that one more time and not have Chris die?
But he's going on my shoulder or my head?
Head. I mean, it's...
Have you been in any real fights?
No. Not since I was 13. I put a kid in hospital and that was it. I never lost my temper since. I walked out. I think I don't know what I would do if I did hit somebody.
Are there any real-world examples of violence that have informed your work on stage?
Oh, God, the world is so full of violence. I don't know. I feel sad. Boy, that was a moment. I don't want this violent stuff to be hanging around. It's stupid. People beating the crap out of each other. You know, talk and it works. But just fighting is wrong. Wrong. Shooting, God, I don't know. But I am, in a way, it makes me feel better that I've said something. And violence, you can say something about, not violence. If I thought for one moment somebody picked up a knife to stab somebody but had an image of something that I created and they stopped, I would feel wonderful. That would be tremendous.
Oh!
B.H. Barry, a fight director at the Metropolitan Opera. He talked with David Cortava of The New Yorker. The Met's production of Verdi's Otello opens this week. And that's it. We're done for now. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kawalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.